Hello, everybody, and thanks for tuning in. This podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and that is supported by Kinexus. Wish you could have Marie Kondo come clean up your finances. If only you could apply the Kondo method to your bills and accounts. At Kinexus, their financial advisors will work with you to streamline and organize your money, creating your own method for cleaning up your finances. Let banking spark joy. Contact a Kinexus financial advisor today by calling 1-800-667-7477. Unraveling. Unsure, undetermined, unnecessary. This is what my life has boiled down to. I either have to stop or die. I can't straddle this fence any longer. I have taken into my lungs the longest breath of hell, and I'm still here. Maybe there is a God. Maybe, just maybe, there is such a lifeline. Something happened last night. Good. I died. Sounds insane, doesn't it? That's taken from Nikki Sixx's diary, dated December 23rd, 1987. It was just the night before the Motley Crue founder and bassist was pronounced dead from a heroin overdose. Nikki started that night not unlike most nights in that era: booze, coke, and heroin. It was the Christmas holidays and in between tours for Motley Crue. The band was at its height. They had never been more popular, but Nikki's personal life had reached a new low. It was that night where he wound up going to a strip club to escape his own decay and loneliness. He went with some members of Guns N' Roses, Megadeth, and Rat, along with some other friends. After they were done with the strip club, they took the party to a hotel Slash was staying at, where they did drugs until their minds went blank. It was there Nikki found himself already so messed up, he wasn't even able to shoot heroin for himself. He needed one of the drug dealers to do it for him. He rolled up the sleeve, tied off the arm with a rubber tube, and plunged the heroin into his veins. It raced to his heart, exploded all over his body, and in an instant, Nikki turned blue. He had lost consciousness. When Nikki opened his eyes, everything was a blur of light, color, and motion. Nikki was on his back and heard, "We're losing him! We're losing him!" Nikki went to sit up and expected some resistance, but there was none at all. Instead, with sounds whooshing past his ears, Nikki shot upright as if he weighed nothing. It felt as if something very gentle was grabbing his head and pulling him upward. As he looked up, all Nikki could see was bright white, and as he looked down, he realized he had left his body. He could see Nikki Sixx, or the body that once contained him, lying on his back, covered head to toe with a sheet, being pushed on a gurney by medics towards an ambulance. He could see his limo. He could see people standing around crying, and just as he was getting some clarity on the situation, felt a not-so-gentle force grab him once again. This time it grabbed his foot as if it were impatient, and yanked him in an instant through the roof of the ambulance, landing with a painful jerk back into his body. As Nikki struggled to open his eyes, it looked like the scene out of Pulp Fiction. An adrenaline needle was poking out of his chest as the medic said, "No one's gonna die in my fucking ambulance." And then everything went black. Eventually, Nikki woke up and came to in a hospital bed. Nikki opened his mouth and sucked in what felt like the first breath of his entire life. He ripped all of the hospital tubes out, put on his leather pants, and staggered out of the hospital and into the parking lot. There, he ran into two teenage girls crying around a candle. On the radio, they had heard Nikki died and was pronounced dead on the scene. Nikki got a ride in their vehicle back to his house as they listened to his own obituary on the radio. Nikki was starting to comprehend that he had been given a second chance at life. Like it was a miracle he was still alive. He saw the concern in the faces of these fans he was riding with and realized he was one of the luckiest guys in the world. He had felt like a loser trapped in his own dark addiction, and now it dawned on him. He actually had millions of Motley Crue fans who cared for him. Nicky was dropped off at his house. The first thing Nicky did after arriving home, he pulled a lump of heroin out of the medicine cabinet, rolled up his sleeve, tied it off, and as he wrote in Motley Crue's memoir titled The Dirt, with one sink of the syringe plunger, realized that all the love and concern of those millions of fans still didn't feel as satisfying as one good shot of heroin. This was Nicky's lowest of the lows. He was so in deep with his addiction that even a near-death experience couldn't shake him. How did Nicky end up this far into his own destruction? The wide-eyed kid entered the Los Angeles music scene in the late 70s, ready to take on the world, full of piss and vinegar, willing to go through anyone in his way of achieving rock superstardom. But now, up to this point in his life, he had fulfilled most of his lifelong dreams. Now what does he do with himself? As Nicky wrote in The Dirt, he lived the orgy of success, girls, and drugs, but now he had a new problem. What do you do after the orgy? Nicky needed to find a new meaning to his life. He needed to find a new goal. He needed to prove something new to himself. And after years of drug abuse and multiple overdoses, that dark path seemed to be his new normal. Maybe the most courageous thing to do, maybe this new obstacle to be conquered, would be something much harder than rock superstardom. Maybe it would be cutting all that bullshit out of his life. Maybe it would take him back to his bedroom in Jerome, Idaho, as a young teenager living with his grandparents. The goal of making music, of giving that feeling to a new generation of kids. To focus on that, instead of the distractions and vices that he has been rampantly caught up in.
The stories behind some of the most famous albums in music history. It's Beyond the Beat with Jared Lennon.
Nicky woke up the next day, sprawled out across his bathroom floor with the needle still dangling out of his arm. The walls and tile floor were covered in blood. After seeing the disaster around him, Nicky immediately passed out again. After hearing the news, their manager at the time, Doc McGee, finally arrived at Nicky's house and found him passed out on his floor. Doc convinced him he needed a detox, and he could use his house for the next week to get away from all the craziness and to be supervised. Nicky's body needed some recovery, and after a long and much-needed sleep, Nicky woke up a new man. It was Christmas Day 1987, and with some clarity after his out-of-body experience, Nicky knew he had gone through something spiritual and profound. He understood that drugs had brought him to his knees, but unlike a lot of his rock and roll heroes, he was given another chance to live his life with a purpose instead of wasting it away. Nicky needed to act on this revelation. As Nicky spent the next few days detoxing, Doc called in a band meeting at his house to discuss the future of Motley Crue. Nicky, Tommy Lee, Vince Neil, and Mick Mars all gathered. Nicky's overdose was the catalyst, but it was far from the only instance of one of them letting their addictions get the best of them. It was even far from the first time one of them almost died. Doc wrote about it in The Dirt, writing, quote, "They looked pathetic. There was Nicky, who was dying, Tommy, who was getting loaded and fighting with his wife, Vince, who was completely out of control, and Mick, who basically woke up every morning and drank and sobbed to himself until he passed out. And this was supposed to be one of the biggest, greatest rock bands in the world?" They would cancel the European leg of the Girls, Girls, Girls tour that was supposed to follow the holidays. They all agreed to rehab. And slowly but surely, all got sober, with minor hiccups in between. In the attempt to start fresh, Nicky sold his house and bought a new one and became a recluse for months at a time, wrestling and navigating this new sober lifestyle. with such a dramatic transformation, you gotta imagine it would produce dramatic results. Nicky had been a serious drug addict for most of Motley Crue's existence, which was coming up on 6 years now. How would Nicky now occupy his time with such a drastic lifestyle change? Well, doing what Nicky did best, diving headfirst into the healthiest of his habits, and his oldest habit, the one that never turned his back on him, his creativity and writing. And that's where the album Dr. Feelgood was born. And what better writing material than having a spiritual out-of-body experience? It was during one of those early writing days, with a new healthy body and a sober mind, Nicky grabbed a guitar and a pen and a pad. Nicky recalled that wild night, looking at his carcass on that ambulance gurney, needing a needle of adrenaline to be stabbed into his chest to revive him, to kickstart his heart. As he sat in this new house of his, Nicky looked back at that time in his life, the craziness, the fast-paced life, always looking for the next fix, the many years of excess, and it all came to Nicky as he started playing his guitar. It was unlike anything he was writing at the time. It was more punk rock, heavy, and based in aggression, something Nicky would have written 6 years earlier for Motley's first album, rather than the riff-based songs they had moved towards. He got out his pen and pad and started writing. "When I get high on speed. Top fuel, funny cars, a drug for me. My heart, kickstart my heart." Nicky's mind was still in that mode of chasing the next high, of still getting that fix. There was still that itch Nicky needed to scratch, but he needed to get it somewhere else rather than the destructive habits he had developed. He continued writing. "Always got the cops coming after me, custom-built bike doing 103. My heart, kickstart my heart. Skydive naked from an aeroplane or a lady with a body from outer space. My heart, kickstart my heart. Say I got trouble, trouble in my eyes. I'm just looking for another good time. My heart, kickstart my heart." Years later, Nicky looked back on the songwriting process in an interview, saying, quote, "Kickstart My Heart conceptually came from the fact that the band, as adrenaline junkies, we had been using everything in the world, from girls, cars, drugs, rock and roll, for adrenaline. And when it stopped working for us, we decided to altogether, as a band, as a gang, say we're not going to do drugs anymore. So what do? You got to kick it up a notch to still get high. And that's kind of what the album had in common. That's what the song was about, and it really is about adrenaline." Interestingly, Nicky thought it was a throwaway song and never thought it would even make the album. Nicky originally wrote the song at his house with the lyrics on a napkin. His manager came over to his house one day, saw the napkin, and asked him about it, and Nicky played it for him. The manager told him he had to show the rest of the band. Nicky was hesitant, though, thinking it maybe wasn't quite right for Motley. His manager told him he was crazy. He needed to show it to the rest of the guys. Nicky later said in an interview, quote, "I remember bringing that into rehearsal and thinking that the song didn't have a hope in hell. It was just so punk rock. As soon as Tommy started playing that beat and Mick started playing the guitar, it instantly sounded like Motley Crue." Kickstart My Heart has since become one of Motley Crue's most recognizable hits. It was the second single off the Dr. Feelgood album, peaking at number 27 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. But more than that, it has endured as a fan favorite even 30-plus years after its release. As Nicky says, the song really set an ethos for what would be the Dr. Feelgood album. Not only was Nicky now sober, but so was the rest of the band. They all had battled demons throughout the 80s, and they all shared in common that those substances had turned ugly for them. They needed to find a replacement for those destructive forces, and that mindset came out in those months of writing and rehearsals leading up to the recording of the Dr. Feelgood album. By the late 70s and early 80s, punk rock was at its peak, a new wave was coming around. Nicky Six wanted to start a band, but his reaction was to go against the grain and against the trends. He wanted to start a band based in something called glam punk, a band with aggression, like the Sex Pistols and Black Sabbath, but with a foot in the door of glam rock, a focus also on how the band looked, fashion, costumes, and hairstyles, emulating his favorite bands like The Sweet and David Bowie. Motley Crue was started in 1981 by bassist Nicky Six and drummer Tommy Lee. Mick Mars soon joined after seeing a local Los Angeles newspaper ad stating that a rude, loud, and aggressive guitar player slot was available. Tommy's old high school pal, Vince Neil, filled the vocalist spot to cap off the foursome. It was that glam punk idea that guided the group that would become Motley Crue, and to Nicky, the direction he wanted to take the band was evident from the start. Vince was the last member to join, and it was at Vince's first ever rehearsal with the band that something special clicked. Tommy Lee wrote about it in The Dirt, writing, quote, "Vince stood there like a little kid, half cocky and half embarrassed, with platinum blonde hair exploding out of his head like fireworks. Nicky gave him some lyrics, and he started singing. He wasn't right on top of the song, but he hit all the right notes and stayed in key. And something else started happening. His squeaky, high-pitched voice, combined with Nicky's ratty, out-of-time bass playing, mix over-amped guitar playing, and my way too busy and excited drumming. And it sounded right." It was at that rehearsal, on the spot, that Nicky decided to rewrite the lyrics to one of their potential songs to better suit Vince's voice. As Tommy wrote in the book, within 5 minutes into their first jam, they had created one of their all-time classic songs. They had finalized what would end up being Livewire, and Motley Crue was born right then and there. Something between those four guys created magic. Nicky was the brains behind the whole operation. He wasn't a natural musician, but what he lacked in bass guitar chops, he made up for in a vision for the band. A game plan. A brand before he even knew what that meant. He had a keen eye on the business side, but his best contribution was to the songwriting. Nicky came from a messed up childhood. He never knew his father, and his mom would often abandon him to go live with new boyfriends, leaving Nicky to live with his grandparents for stretches of time. It set Nicky up for a lot of instability and anger later on. But he used that emotional burden as fuel in Motley's music and lyrics. Underneath what usually come off as hard-rocking party songs are a lot of dark and dirty subjects topped with powerful imagery. With Tommy, they had a fun-loving, happy-go-lucky kind of guy that brought great drumming skills. Tommy was never satisfied with just laying down a beat and a rhythm for the rest of the band. He added an element of musicality that you don't see from a lot of drummers, accenting certain guitar and bass parts with crash cymbals or tom-tom fills, and for their live shows, you could be caught just watching Tommy the whole time. He never stopped moving. He'd be a ball of energy and excitement, always looking like he's having the time of his life behind a kit, and he was a showman through and through. When he wasn't pounding them on the drums, he'd be spinning his drumsticks like propellers in between his fingers, or bouncing them off the snare drum into the air and catching them. He struck a great balance between drum technicality and the ability to get people moving at their shows. Mick, he was the perfect writing partner for Nicky. A lot of times Nicky would have ideas of where he wanted to go with songs, maybe a set of lyrics or a chord progression. Mick was a riff-writing machine, and a heavy guitar player at that. For the pop sensibilities Nicky provided with his melodies and writing style, Mick would intensify and put the songs through a heavy metal filter through his aggressive riffs and crunchy distortion. And for Vince, what he lacked in vocal versatility and technicality, he made up for in his charisma and sex appeal. All the girls wanted to be with him, and all the guys wanted to be him. He was a perfect frontman for a loud, aggressive metal band, a yin to that yang side of the Motley Crue that would appeal more to the female demographic. And it's not to say he didn't have great singing chops. His natural, uniquely high voice layered nicely over the heavy metal music they were putting out, and he could put some grit into his voice to add aggression if the songs needed it. And so this newly formed band now needed a name. Nicky had an idea and was thinking about calling the band Christmas, but everyone else hated that idea. It was Mick who remembered an incident that occurred a few years prior when he was playing with a band called White Horse, when one of the other band members called the group a motley-looking crew. Mick took note of that name, wrote it down, and now years later brought it to this new band of his. They modified the spelling, and inspired by a German beer they were drinking at the time, decided to add two sets of metal umlauts above the name, Motley Crue. During those early days, Motley Crue was more of a gang than a band. They all lived in the same shoddy apartment together off the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, and they did everything together. They got drunk, did crazy amounts of cocaine, and walked around the Sunset Strip dressed to the nines in their stage garb, stiletto heels, spandex, and a cloud of hairspray. They made a name for themselves as hometown heroes, playing clubs like the Whiskey A Go-Go, the Roxy, and the Troubadour, and they got a big following quick. They would cut dolls' heads off on stage, Nicky would light himself on fire, and they'd basically do anything for attention, as long as it was cheap and looked cool. It worked, and they were soon headlining these clubs they had gone to as fans just months prior. In November of 1981, they released their first album, Too Fast for Love, on their own record label, Leather Records. It cost them $6,000 to make, and with the help of their new manager, sold 20,000 copies. Established record labels couldn't ignore the buzz for long, and by early 1982, Motley was signed to a deal with Elektra Records. Elektra A&R man Tom Zutaut was credited with finding the band and described what their live shows were like in those early years and what he saw in them, writing in Motley's book The Dirt, writing, quote, 500 teenagers, the club's capacity, were going berserk for this Motley Crue band, and they looked amazing. Nicky was so intense, it seemed like he would be in the streets killing somebody if he wasn't playing bass. He hit the strings so hard that he kept splitting the skin between his fingers. Watching him throttle that thing with blood flying off his fingers, the strings seemed like razor blades. Vince was one of the best-looking and most charismatic singers I had ever seen. Woman's legs spread open just watching him sing. He was the exact opposite of the guitarist. Looking at him was like seeing Satan reincarnated, though he turned out to be the nicest of the bunch when he wasn't drinking. Tommy looked like an overexcited kid, but at the same time, he seemed like the only natural-born musician in the band. He was a high-quality drummer, a good showman, and constantly in motion. He seemed like the linchpin that held the whole thing together. Zutaut was not only impressed with their onstage show, but with their leader's vision as well. While Tommy fidgeted, Mick drank his face off, and Vince screwed girls, Nicky would go into long discussions with Zutaut about his vision for Motley Crue. Behind the hairspray, eyeshadow, and leather pants was a very intelligent and very passionate man. Nicky was the clear-cut leader. He mapped out each stage of the band, how he knew that kids were sick of new wave and angry at punk rock for selling out, and that they were bored to death of Foreigner, Fleetwood Mac, and anything that was playing on light FM pop radio. Nicky wanted to expand the 500 people sellouts he had at the Whiskey A Go-Go into a rock revolution. After going on their first tour outside of LA, a short one in Canada, the boys hunkered down and started writing what would end up being the Shout at the Devil album. With mountains of cocaine getting them through their first ever recording sessions as a band with a record label, Motley Crue released the album in September of 1983. It was their breakthrough album, selling 200,000 copies within its first 2 weeks of release. If Too Fast for Love was the band's underground success without any promotion, Shout at the Devil was Motley being legitimized in the mainstream. It appealed to die-hard metal fans with the heaviness of the songs, but still featured clever pop hooks. They were one of the first metal groups to successfully cross over a male and female audience. And the controversy the album generated with its association with the devil only seemed to help the sales. Christian and conservative groups rallied against it, and that only generated more press. With the band's use of a pentagram on the album cover, the song God Bless the Children of the Beast, as well as the Charles Manson-associated Beatles song they covered, Helter Skelter. All publicity is good publicity, right? The album peaked at number 17 on the Billboard charts with the help of hits like the album's title track, Looks That Kill, and Too Young to Fall in Love. It would be the last album over a stretch of a few years where Nicky was solely focused on generating success with great music and interesting lyrics. The success that followed sent the boys down a rabbit hole of excess and girls, drugs, and trouble with the law, and the music would start to take a back seat in importance. It was during the Shout at the Devil recordings where Nicky first started experimenting with heroin, first smoking it, then shooting it, then combining it with cocaine. But as Nicky wrote in The Dirt, it didn't get real destructive until the tour in support of the album's release, when they found themselves surrounded by enablers. He wrote, quote, "The more fucked up we got, the greater people thought we were, and the more they supplied us with what we needed to get even more fucked up. Radio stations brought us groupies. Management gave us drugs. Everyone we met made sure we were constantly fucked and fucked up, We thought nothing about whipping out our dicks and urinating on the floor of a radio station during an interview, or fucking the on-air host if she was halfway decent looking. We thought we had elevated animal behavior to an art form. But then we met Ozzy. Motley Crue would go on to open for Ozzy Osbourne on his 1984 tour across America. The tour ended up launching Motley Crue out of their hometown hero status and into the minds of kids across the country, but it nearly killed them. Ozzy took the boys under his wing at a time in Ozzy's life when he was his most destructive. He would spend all his time on Motley's bus, snorting cocaine, partying from city to city. When out of cocaine one day, under the noonday sun, still messed up from the night before and wearing an old lady's dress, Ozzy grabbed the coke straw from Nikki and snorted a whole line of ants. He then proceeded to take his dick out, piss on the pavement, and without missing a beat, bent down and started licking his own piss up. Not to be outdone and not to ruin any reputation, Nikki caved under the pressure and started doing the same after Ozzy ordered him to. So under a full view of families and old woman and everything, Nikki unzipped his pants, whipped out his dick, and pissed. But as he went down to lick it up, Ozzy swooped in and beat him to the punch. This was the craziness Motley Crue experienced on a day-to-day basis in those days, before anyone got truly hurt. As insane as those stories are, they're actually quite innocent at what was to come for all four members of Motley Crue. And as what they detailed 5 years after that tour with Ozzy, if we now skirt ahead again to the Dr. Feelgood album. And as part of the lyrical influence on the title track of the album, the album's first single, Dr. Feelgood. The song is written about a topic Nikki knew a lot about, drug dealers. Nikki was inspired by a riff Mick had come up with one day as they prepared to record the album. The main hook and lyrics came to him out of thin air, as Nikki explained in an interview, saying, quote, "I remember coming into rehearsal and Mick started playing this riff, and I instantly said the words, 'He's the one they got, Dr. Feelgood.' And it just kind of meshed right then. And then we started playing the verse thing, and Tommy came up with a heavy rhythm. He's always good for coming up with a rhythm and the part that really gets you moving." Nikki is great at painting these vivid pictures in the listener's mind in his verses he writes. A lot of the songs throughout his writing career, Nikki has these specific detail-filled verses and then follows it up with these simple, repeatable hooks in the chorus. And it was no different on Dr. Feelgood, as he writes about a fictional drug dealer named Jimmy. Nikki encompassed into Jimmy the characteristics of a lot of the drug dealers he had dealt with in the past, writing, "Rat-tailed Jimmy is the second-hand hood he deals out in Hollywood. Got a 65 Chevy, primered flames, traded for some powdered goods. Jigsaw Jimmy, he's running a gang, but I hear he's doing okay. Got a cozy little job, sells the Mexican mob packages of candy cane. He's the one they call Dr. Feelgood. He's the one that makes you feel all right. He's the one they call Dr. Feelgood." Nikki packs in as much detail in that short verse as possible and wrote another great third verse in the song. "He'll tell you he's the king of these barrio streets, moving up to Shangri-La. Came by his wealth as a matter of luck. Says he never broke no law. Two-time loser, running out of juice. Time to move out quick. Heard a rumor going around, Jimmy's going down. This time it's gonna stick." Nikki's never come out and said this, but I wonder if the rise of hip-hop and rap had any influence on his songwriting. Dr. Feelgood could easily be a rap, maybe similar to Walk This Way by Aerosmith, which eventually did turn into a rap with Run DMC. Nikki initially had a different set of lyrics for Dr. Feelgood when they recorded it as a demo, but their producer, Bob Rock, pushed Nikki to improve them because he knew he could do better. Nikki talked about it in an interview, saying, quote, "When we got up to Vancouver to record the album, Bob Rock took me aside and said, 'I think you can do better,' which I'm really glad that he pushed me to do that, because then it kind of came around to that song representing the artwork and the artwork and the tour. It all kind of fell into place, and the concept behind things like Kickstart My Heart and stuff like that. So that was really probably a big turning point for us." Dr. Feelgood was the second song on the album, but it might as well be the first. The first track, TNT, or Terror in Tinseltown, is a quick 43-second track that kind of just sets the mood for the rest of the album. It features sirens, people screaming, and ends with a car crash as it slides right into the song Dr. Feelgood. I'm probably looking way too much into it, but maybe a bit of a metaphor for the band crashing down after their Girls, Girls, Girls album, fighting through it, and coming out of the crash on the other side. Dr. Feelgood was the album's first single, released just a few days before the album was released, on September 1st, 1989. It has since become Motley Crue's most commercially successful single, peaking at number 6 on the Billboard Top 100, and became their first single to be certified gold by November of that year. Bob Rock definitely deserves a lot of credit for how well Dr. Feelgood turned out as an album. At the time, Bob Rock was a little-known Canadian producer who had some mild success both as a musician and as a producer. He had made his name first as an engineer, working alongside Bruce Fairbairn, and together they did such smash albums as Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet, as well as Aerosmith's Permanent Vacation. Rock then moved to the producer's chair, where Motley Crue was won over, producing bands like The Cult, Kingdom Come, and Ted Nugent. Rock did most of those albums in a studio in Vancouver called Little Mountain Sound, and so Motley Crue moved away for those few months, away from their distractions in LA, to record Dr. Feelgood in Canada. Rock set out to make the record sound huge, to expand every sound to the max, to get the guitar, drums, bass, and layered background vocals all as big and weighty as possible. That's how Rock made a name for himself, and he achieved every inch of that with Dr. Feelgood. He was able to combine the catchiness, the pop element Motley Crue already had, but without sacrificing any of the heaviness in the songs. Rock also knew of Motley's reputation. He understood these guys had basically spent the last decade doing whatever they wanted, up until the consequences started piling up. He knew these guys were now a sober band for the first time ever, their career was on the line, and it might be awkward between the band members now that they can't mask their demons with drugs or alcohol. So Rock made all the guys record their parts in the studio by themselves. For example, he'd have Tommy in the studio the whole day just by himself, with none of the other guys around, sitting there, fidgeting, maybe getting on Tommy's nerves, telling him what parts he screwed up or anything like that. The other guys would have the day off, and it worked quite well. Bob pushed the band and worked them tirelessly to get the perfect takes. But they went through the recording process with little conflict, something Motley Crue could not say for their previous albums. We left off the history behind the band in 1984, where they went on a tour opening for Ozzy Osbourne. A successful tour, if you look at it from the business side, where thousands of kids were now exposed to the band, making their Shout at the Devil album even more commercially successful. But it was disastrous if you look at the habits the band members were starting to form and where their personal lives were all headed. It was now the end of that tour. It was December of 1984, with all the guys back home in Los Angeles, when they decided to throw a little barbecue to celebrate the early beginnings of working on their third album. One day turned to two, and 2 days turned to three pretty quickly for the party. Nobody wanted to go home. On the third night, their booze was running out, so Vince decided he'd go on a beer run. He had just bought a 1972 Ford Pantera, and another guy at the party wanted to see what it was like to ride in. The other guy was Nicholas Dingley, nicknamed Razzle, the drummer in another band in the glam punk scene, Hanoi Rocks. So Vince and Razzle, both really drunk, jumped into Vince's new car to get some alcohol. Vince wanted to show it off a bit and was going 65 miles per hour in a 25 zone when he started to lose control of the vehicle on a curve in the road. The vehicle slid sideways, right into oncoming traffic, and smashed into another vehicle. Tommy wrote in the dirt that he remembers ambulances screeching by the house and everyone at the party going to check up on the commotion. He said he came up onto the scene, seeing Vince sitting on the curb by himself, covered in blood, with his arms wrapped around his ankles, rocking back and forth. The vehicle was smashed with glass littered everywhere, and Razzle was being carried off in a stretcher. Razzle was later pronounced dead at the hospital. The two people in the other vehicle were seriously injured and suffered brain damage. Vince blew a blood alcohol level of 0.17 at the scene. Vince would be charged with vehicular manslaughter, but got away with just $25,000 bail, 5 years of probation, 200 hours of community service, $2.6 million in restitution, and 15 days in jail. But before all that, he needed to go to rehab. The rest of the guys were so messed up that they barely even called Vince or checked up on him. They were in their own dark dimensions. Once Vince returned from rehab, they decided to get to work on their third album. There was no tearful reunion, though. It was now more awkward than ever before. As Vince attempted to get sober, the rest of the guys hit a new peak in their addictions. Nicky had written songs for the album, but the music took a backseat to the drugs, and he barely knew what he was doing anymore. The album would eventually be Theater of Pain, and was released in June of 1985. It marked the band steering away from the traditional heavy metal style towards more hair metal or glam metal. The album was extremely successful, peaking at number 6 on the Billboard chart, the hits Home Sweet Home and their cover of Smokin' in the Boys Room largely driving that success. But besides those two songs, the band was pretty disappointed with their efforts. Nicky later called it, quote, a pile of rubbish, the whole fucking record with a few moments of maybe brilliance. Vince wrote about touring behind the album in the dirt, writing, quote, every night when I ran around stage in my pink leather pants that laced up the sides, I felt like the only one sober enough to realize how bad some of the songs were. I was shocked the record went double platinum, and maybe it just reinforced the idea that we were so great, we could even get away with putting out a terrible album. As part of the promotion of Theater of Pain, Motley Crue opened up for their musical heroes Cheap Trick in Europe. It was during one of the last shows when Nicky experienced an overdose for the first time. Nicky, along with another member of Hanoi Rocks, the guitarist Andy McCoy, hopped into a cab after their show and found a random dealer near a row of crumbling tenement houses in London. Nicky was so messed up before they even got there, he needed this degenerate-looking dealer to shoot the heroin into his arm for him. Nicky could feel the heroin racing through his veins, just like it was any other hit in those years, until he felt it explode in his heart. That's when he instantly knew he should have never trusted a shoddy dealer to shoot him up. Nicky coughed and gagged and soon turned blue. When Nicky woke up, he was being dragged on the shoulder of the dealer like an old trash bag. He had ice down his pants from Andy trying to wake him up, and welts all over his arms and chest from being struck by a baseball bat. It was the dealer's idea to try wake him up by inflicting pain. It was Nicky's first overdose, but it certainly wasn't his last. After the Theater of Pain tour came rehearsals and recording for what would be the Girls, Girls, Girls album. And just like Theater of Pain, the excesses in their personal lives led to another lackluster effort. And this time, it was starting to drive the members apart. With Vince's arrest and the probation he faced, the other guys started looking down on him anytime he'd drink a beer or do any drugs. Meanwhile, Nicky's heroin addiction was at its peak, and Mick was drinking his face off. To top it off, Tommy was now married to Heather Locklear, which meant he was separated from the guys in a multi-million dollar home in a gated community. Nicky wrote about this time in the dirt, writing, quote, like Theater of Pain, Girls, Girls, Girls could have been a phenomenal record, but we were too caught up in our own personal bullshit to put any effort into it. You can actually hear the distance that had grown between us in our performance. If we hadn't managed to force two songs out of ourselves, the title track and Wild Side, the album would have been the end of our careers. In the studio, we were each mixing our drugs with something we had never combined them with before: guilt, denial, and secrecy. And those three words are the difference between an addict and a hedonist. Tommy was in Heatherland, which just wasn't a land of paradise, but also a lot of discipline, where he had to hide his drug use from her. Because of it, he was becoming a stressed-out wreck. Vince was trying to stay sober, but failing miserably, distracting himself from his own unhappiness with girls and mud wrestling. And Mick was up to something behind our backs, though none of us had any idea what that was. Girls, Girls, Girls came out in May of 1987, and just like Theater of Pain, sold very well. It topped out at number 2 on the Billboard charts, and just like their previous album, went quadruple platinum. The title track, Girls, 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 gave them their second top 20 hit. Meanwhile, Wild Side, their second single, was played heavily on MTV. Kids were eating up whatever they would put out, but the band members were barely getting through the process alive. There's one story from the recording of the album where Mick was barely keeping it together with a constant mix of booze and painkillers. He was recording the staccato guitar line at the end of the song, Girls, 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 when he fell out of the chair because he was so drunk. Everyone kind of liked how it sounded, though, so they kept it in the song's final take if you listen back to the ending of it today. For the tour that followed, they had their own private plane, endless cash, and could do whatever they wanted. For a while, they even had a drug kingpin following them around with a license plate that read dealer, and whenever he'd meet the band, he'd appear with his diamond Rolex, gold chains, and a girl on each arm, and throw bindles of coke to everyone in the band and the crew. The tour carried on until December of 1987, when they all took a break back home in LA for the holidays, before a planned European tour the following year. That's when Motley Crue hit rock bottom. And it took another one of Nicky's heroin overdoses, the one where he was pronounced dead, to signal to the band and its management that enough was enough. Everyone was realizing this reckless behavior wasn't making anyone happy anymore. Nicky's overdose didn't surprise anyone else in the band, but it was the news of his death and that initial shock that did the trick. It made Vince, Tommy, and Mick look in the mirror and see how far everything had gotten. In early 1988, Nicky, Vince, Mick, and Tommy entered rehab and group therapy to fight their demons. And for the most part, everyone bought in. They all sobered up. There would be short and minor relapses, of course, but they were on this journey together. And it tightened up the band again. They were all fighting this fight. It wasn't a court-ordered rehab like it was for Vince, while the others looked from afar with disgust as they slid deeper into their own addictions. This was unifying. And with sober minds, they could reflect on their past, especially on their efforts for the last two albums, Theater of Pain and Girls, 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 and understand that it was far from their best. For Nicky, as the main songwriter, he now found himself being productive with his time and writing songs again on a consistent basis. It wasn't like those last couple of albums, where at the last minute he crunched out as many songs as he could. He now had the time and clarity to cut the fat out of his writing, and for really the first time, get together with the rest of the band to make it more of a democratic process, discussing the songs and changing them until they all liked them. It was more of a dictatorship with Nicky's songs and Nicky's vision before. And so after months of rehabilitation centers and the guys getting used to their new sober lifestyles, they decided it was time to get to work. They all agreed they needed to find a new producer and loved the massive sounds Bob Rock had generated with the bands he had produced. They all moved up to Vancouver and after a decade of drugs, deaths, marriages, and rehab, discovered for the first time what it was like to record an album sober. In an interview, Nicky talked about how they were now more unified as a group, saying, quote, "We were a gang. We were a gang like we were on the first record. And it wasn't about the money. We all had so much money we couldn't spend it. It wasn't about the girls, because we all were in relationships, so we weren't out chasing girls. It wasn't about the drugs, because we had quit doing the drugs and quit drinking. So it was only about the music." Nicky wrote in the dirt that Bob Rock whipped them into shape like galley slaves. Their old producer, Tom Werman, would say, "Okay, that's good enough." Whereas Rock would say, "That just isn't your best." Rock made Mick spend 2 weeks doubling a guitar part over and over until it was perfectly synchronized. Whereas during the Shout at the Devil recordings, Mick finished the full album's guitar in the same time frame. Nicky wrote, quote, "Bob was critical, demanding, and a stickler for punctuality. 6 months of rigor combined with 6 months of sobriety tore the life out of us, and we all had to put up with each other's violent and sudden mood swings. Before we walked in the studio each day, we never knew whether we'd leave that evening feeling like the best band in the world or four angry clowns who couldn't even play their instruments. In 8 years together and with millions of albums sold, we had never recorded properly. No one had ever pushed us to the limits of our abilities before or kept demanding more than we thought we could give until we discovered that we actually did have more to give." Aerosmith was actually recording their Pump album in the studio next to them. They were on the same journey as Motley, a former dysfunctional and addict-ridden band on the brink of destruction, but brought back to life with sobriety. The two bands even shared the same drug counselor. Of course, the sober lifestyle was the antithesis of every punk principle the guys previously had, so they tried to make up for it in the songs. They set out to make an album full of loud, raw, sloppy, mistake-filled rock and roll, and that they did. I talked about the first two singles off the album, Kickstart My Heart and Dr. Feelgood, two of their biggest hits ever. What do you notice when you hear them? Well, coming off a largely disappointing album in Girls, 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 it's the production. The songs sound huge. Tommy, who is always a standout on the drums, was only elevated with Bob Rock as the mastermind behind the great drum sound. On Dr. Feelgood, Tommy solidified his place as one of the all-time great rock drummers. He's more of a musician, creating riffs on the drums, rather than just keeping time. You could isolate just the drums during the Dr. Feelgood intro, for example, and you'd know exactly what song it was. Mick really shines on the album as well. The guitars sound super heavy on Dr. Feelgood, and he captures the listener's attention right from the get-go on Kickstart, with the use of the whammy bar to make his guitar sound like an engine revving up. For the solo later on in the song, Mick uses a talk box to make his guitar stand out more, and then the song ends by singing the words Kickstart My Heart through the talk box effect. It's those little things that make the song so memorable. In an interview, Tommy talked about how they noticed right away the positive influence Bob had on Mick's playing in the studio, saying, quote, "Bob really pulled a lot of things out of him that ourselves or another producer couldn't, because Bob was a guitar player. And I guess there's something about being a guitar player in the same wavelength, and he's just pulling stuff out of Mick like tricks out of a hat." It was also in Kickstart where you could maybe see some of the emotional effects of being sober. In the breakdown bridge part of the song, Vince sings a few lines, looking back on the history of the band and how they've overcome so much, singing, "When we started this band, all we needed was a laugh. Years gone by, I'd say we've kicked some ass. When I'm enraged or hitting the stage, adrenaline rushing through my veins, and I'd say we're still kicking ass." And then he concludes it all by singing triumphantly, "And to think we did all of this to rock." It's a nice little moment to a song that otherwise is just a banger from start to finish. But as a whole, Motley Crue was not out to win humanitarian awards with their lyrics. Nicky always wrote about the dark side of life, and on Dr. Feelgood, really embraced the trend in hair metal at the time to write ridiculous, silly, and mostly fun lyrics about girls. This was far from the Me Too movement. This era produced, well, look at their previous album in Girls, 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 a song all about strippers, or the massive hits of the day like Cherry Pie by Warrant, Pour Some Sugar on Me by Def Leppard, or The Scorpions' Rock You Like a Hurricane. Dr. Feelgood produced a bunch of these songs. None of them were hits, but I guess you can say they appeased the fans that still wanted those, quote, stripper anthems. Slice of Your Pie, Sticky Sweet, and She Goes Down all fall into that category. They all have ridiculous lyrics, but they're fun, and it's easy to pick them apart for how shallow they are. But you could also look at it as Motley Crue just being self-aware, not trying to be anything other than they were at the time. A fun, hard-rocking party band. You can't say the same thing on the song Time for a Change, but we'll get to that in a little bit. All three of those songs feature great background gang vocals. They're all heavy rockers, and all really led by Mick's heavy guitar riffs. On Slice of Your Pie, Vince sings, "Hey pretty pretty with the sweet sweet eyes, order me up another slice of your pie. Hey pretty pretty from across the room, got something sticky sweet for you. Order me up another slice of you." Nothing too introspective about those lyrics. They pay homage to the Beatles though during the outro of the song, where they follow the same chord progression and similar background vocals to the Beatles song I Want You, She's So Heavy. For the song Sticky Sweet, maybe not as strong of a song as Slice of Your Pie. It doesn't have the hooks like most of their other songs on the album, but again, follows the same lyrical path about girls, with the lyrics, "Now when I've done good, she slaps me on the ass, it takes more than 10 seconds to satisfy this lass. The way she walks, I swear should be a crime, sirens scream every time you walk by. She's so sticky, so sticky, so sticky, she's so sticky, she's so sticky sweet." Not to beat a dead horse, but yeah, leaving nothing to the imagination. These songs are the reason why a band like Steel Panther exists now. What's interesting about Sticky Sweet, though, it was one of the few songs that originated with Mick Mars. Mick has said that he came up with the main parts of the song in his head after meeting with Bob Rock for the first time. He said he was brimming with so much excitement over the possibility of working with this guy that most of the music was written in his head on the car ride back from that initial meeting. I mentioned that part of Bob's great sound in the studio was the background vocals. Well, they had help with some heavy hitters on the album. For Sticky Sweet, Steven Tyler and Brian Adams both added their talents to the choruses. Like I said, Aerosmith was recording next door, and Adams actually lived in Vancouver at the time, and obviously, both have great distinctive voices. You can really hear Tyler in the main chorus. And as far as She Goes Down, they got Robin Zander from Cheap Trick, along with a few others to sing. For the lyrics, it's much of the same stuff. With a flat on my back, she goes down. For a backstage pass, she goes down. With all of my friends, she goes down. She gives heart attack, she goes. Mick is great again on the guitar on this one, even mixing it up with a little blues in the solo. A song in the vein of those three, in terms of lyrics about girls and driven by heavy guitar, leads us to the fourth track on the album. It's Rattlesnake Shake. Like I said, nothing too interesting about the lyrics, but goes to show that the band was experimenting with sounds in the studio. In Rattlesnake Shake, a horn section stands out in the chorus and near the ending of the song. Also near the end features a bluesy piano solo, something no one had heard from the crew before. As for the lyrics, much of the same as the last three songs I mentioned, with She's Got Sassy Class, Bring You to Your Knees. When she shakes her ass, she's a voodoo child. Just one look will drive you wild. Slide through the night with a viper's smile. Come on there, girl, won't you shake that thing? Doing the rattlesnake shake, 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 rattlesnake shake, make my body ache. Let's move on to the third single released off the album, The Ballad Without You. If hair metal was good at anything, it was producing those stripper anthems, as I mentioned before, but also good at producing the power ballad. It's what made the genre so commercially successful. It appealed to the men with the hard-rocking songs about girls and sex, but also appealed to the female audience with slower and more sensitive songs about love. Without You falls into the latter category. Nikki wrote it about Tommy's relationship at the time with Heather Locklear. Nikki talked about it in an interview with Rolling Stone, saying, quote, "That was a very simple idea for a song, which I had written a lyric about Heather Locklear and Tommy. They were coming over to my house all the time. I thought to myself one day, without you coming from Tommy's perspective, life would not be the same. It was a good relationship at that time. It was sort of a romantic moment." Nikki wrote simple lyrics for this one, almost as if it were a love letter written by Tommy about Heather. The song opens up with, "Without you, there's no change. My nights and days are gray. If I reached out and touched the rain, it just wouldn't feel the same. Without you, I'd be lost. I'd slip down from the top. I'd slide down so low. Girl, you'd never, never know. Without you, a sailor lost at sea. Without you, woman, the world comes down on me." And then in the bridge, as they build toward the solo, "I could face a mountain, but I could never climb alone. I could start another day, but how many, I just don't know. You're the reason the sun shines down, and the nights, they don't grow cold. Only you that I'll hold when I'm young, only you as we grow old." Without You is credited to Nikki and Mick, and Mick's guitar really stands out on the song as well. He used a steel guitar for the main guitar hook, an instrument mostly used in country music, not rock. Vince deserves a lot of credit on Without You as well. He pours his heart and soul into the lyrics, and it's arguably his most emotive vocal performance to date. Vince gets a lot of flack for his live show performances, but I think people forget how good he was in the 80s. He was one of the best vocalists in the hair metal scene, with a perfect mix of beauty in his unique, high-pitched voice, but also with enough sleaze to match Nikki's dark lyrics. Without You was another successful single off the Dr. Feelgood album for the crew, reaching number 8 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. Moving on to the fifth single off the album, released as a single a month short of the one-year anniversary of Dr. Feelgood, the song is Same Old Situation. It's Motley's ode to lesbianism. Nikki talked about it with Rolling Stone magazine, saying, quote, "That was about a girl leaving a guy for a girl. The subject plagues men worldwide. I love it because when Elektra heard it, they were like, oh, this is perfect for a single. In Motley fashion, we were like, wonderful, we'll tell you later that it's about lesbians." Vince added to it, saying, quote, "That's about chicks leaving you for chicks. It happens. It definitely happens. It's worse than a chick leaving you for a guy because there's nothing you can do about it." The song kind of addresses the fact that homosexuality was becoming more accepted in the late 80s, and experimenting with the same sex was becoming more normal. The person within the song, the guy, is talking about an ex-girlfriend who discovered woman, so to speak. To avoid emasculation, the guy adopts a "that's just the way it goes" kind of attitude. Nikki wrote the lyrics. Now I used to call her Cindy. She changed her name to Sin. I guess that's the name of her game. I really used to love her. Then the kitty she discovered. It's got to be a sexual thing. Now all around the world, girls will be girls. It's the same old situation. And then later in the second verse, introduced me to her lover in a cellophane dress. Then they bid me a sweet farewell. Last time I saw them, they were kissing so softly to the sound of wedding bells. The music video for the song featured the band playing a live outdoor show in East Troy, Wisconsin. What's interesting is that they shot all of the video footage for it just 24 days before they released the video. It was Motley's tribute to their fans who had made the Dr. Feelgood tour their best-selling tour to date, as well as that album being their bestseller as well. The song peaked at number 78 on the Billboard Singles chart and number 34 on the mainstream rock chart. To date, it's their third most played song in their live shows from the album, trailing only the title track and Kickstart My Heart, with more than 1,000 plays since its release. I had quickly talked about Motley dipping their toes into unfamiliar waters with one of the songs off the album. It's the last song on Dr. Feelgood, and it's really their first song getting into the political sphere. It's called Time for a Change. Of course, written by Nikki, but also by someone by the name of Donna McDaniel. She had never had a writing credit with Motley Crue before. She was a backup singer for their live shows, starting with the Girls, Girls, Girls tour. The song is a controversial one for Motley Crue fans. For an album that had songs like She Goes Down and Sticky Sweet, silly songs about girls and sex, fans were puzzled it was all capped off with a song about world peace and Time for a Change. But I think it was a reflection of where the guys' heads were at during that period. They weren't young punks in the music scene in their early 20s anymore. They were all in serious relationships by this point. Vince, Nikki, and Mick had kids. And of course, they were now sober. They were looking beyond just the confines of writing about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The song starts off with, I heard some kids telling me how they lost all the faith in the way. They've been talking world peace and the wars in the streets. The lines on their face so deep. A revolution or reach out and touch the day. We're overdue, child. Change. Now it's time for change. The band respected Bob Rock as their producer so much that they let him play bass for the recording of the song. Bob saw mild success as a bass player in a Canadian band called the Payolas in the late 70s and early 80s, so it wasn't like he couldn't handle himself on it. And I think they just wanted to pay their respects to him and thank him in some way because they saw how much he added to the recording process. Time for a Change was the last song on the album, and the band has gotten a lot of flack for it because what would have capped off the album perfectly in a lot of fans' opinions would be the song I want to talk about next. The last song to talk about, and the fourth single released from Dr. Feelgood, it's Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away. It's a rare song for Motley Crue, in the fact you could easily see it sliding into other genres, and I guess it's a testament to how good it really is. It almost has a country feel to it, and the lyrics tell a story kind of like a country song would as well. It's a feel-good, laid-back song, with acoustic guitar playing the main rhythm guitar for a change. Nikki wrote it as a breakup song, but with a twist. The story in the song explains how the main character and this girl have had some good times together, but they've grown apart, and now he wants his freedom. From the guy's perspective, it comes off as quite sensitive and mature for the first half of the song. He's understanding of her side of the story, like he's letting her down easy, but then he really drives the message home near the end, repeating the phrase, "Girl, don't go away mad, just go away." Humor me for just a second, but if we look at where Motley Crue is in their history as a band and where they were heading, it's almost as if the song was foreshadowing what was to come with singer Vince Neil. If we fast forward to 2 years after the album was released, the band had been on the road almost nonstop in support of the Dr. Feelgood album, on top of the pressures of maintaining their sobriety. The guys in the band were at their wits' end by the time 1992 came around. Depending on who you ask, Vince was either kicked out or quit the band after constant conflict in the rehearsal studio. It just basically came down to the band being around each other too much without many breaks. There was a lot of anger and resentment from both parties during the time, but if you take that aspect away, you could look at it like any other long-term relationship between a guy and a girl. They both had some great times together, but they had grown apart, and what would be best for both sides is to move on. Don't cling to what you once had. Don't hold resentment. Just go away. And there's snippets of the song where you can make the analogy. Nicki wrote in one part, "Nothing left to do, too many things were said to ever make it feel like yesterday did. Seasons must change, separate paths, separate ways. If we blame it on anything, let's blame it on the rain." It's an acceptance that the great times are over, that too many things have happened to ever go back to those innocent times. And at the point of Vince's departure, they had been a band for more than a decade. They had countless great times. But as I mentioned in this podcast, they suffered through a lot, and they weren't those innocent glam punk kids in their early 20s anymore. In the song, Nicki even references a hit off their Shout at the Devil album from 1983. He writes about the song Too Young to Fall in Love, a song written about a destructive relationship destined to fall apart, with the line, "I knew it all along, I'd have to write this song, too young to fall in love, guess we knew it all along." And then moving on to the next part of the song, writing, "That's all right, that's okay, we were walking through some youth, smiling through pain. That's all right, that's okay, let's turn the page." Like I said, obviously Nicki wrote it about a fictional couple, but it's quite ironic how it fits the narrative of Vince leaving or being fired, what would be 2.5 years after Dr. Feelgood was released. Nicki has said that the song started with the title, "Don't Go Away, Matt, Just Go Away," and got the inspiration from a movie somewhere, likely from a line of dialogue in the 1986 movie Heartbreak Ridge, where a soldier in the Marines refuses to provide any information to a sergeant, dismissing him with the line, "Don't go away mad, just go away." One of the reasons Motley Crue had such staying power was their videos, their powerful visuals all coming at the time of MTV being launched. It's probably why hair metal was so popular in the 80s, the standout visuals coinciding with MTV's extreme rise in popularity. Motley Crue fit into that era perfectly. They knew what they were doing with their look, almost as important to them as the songs. When they released Shout at the Devil in the early 80s, they were heavily into the post-apocalyptic movie Mad Max, so they adopted the leather, the studs, the armor, and the road warrior look. By the Theater of Pain album, they got bored of the Mad Max look and adopted a full-on glam look, with colorful, more theatrical outfits, polka-dotted or striped spandex, and tons of makeup. Once they started seeing a lot of bands in the scene copying that, they stripped it all down to a biker look with no makeup during the Girls, Girls, Girls era, and continued on with the Dr. Feelgood era with a lot of tight-fitting leather clothing. But no matter what they wore and how they acted, you couldn't take your eyes off them. And with that focus on visuals, MTV picked up and played their videos almost non-stop in those days. And the success of Dr. Feelgood only gave them more play. The title track, Dr. Feelgood, featured a video based on the lyrics in the song, which is quite similar to the story in the movie Scarface, a young drug lord who rises up quickly, but eventually meets his downfall. The video also featured the band playing along to the track in a large tent in the middle of the desert. Inside the tent, the scene around the band resembles a junkyard going up in flames, and as the song nears the end, the band goes on a rampage, smashing windows and their instruments, and lighting anything they can on fire. For the second single, Kickstart My Heart, once again, the video follows along to the theme in the track, and for this one, it's adrenaline. It starts off with the band being driven in a vehicle by a popular comedian at the time, Sam Kinison. It's a taste of nostalgia, as they're on their way back to where it all began for the band, the Sunset Strip and the Whiskey A Go-Go Club. The video features the band playing a show there, now at the height of their popularity, along with shots of car and boat crashes and skydivers, a subtext to the band now searching for natural highs. Along the theme of nostalgia, it then takes a quick look at videos throughout their history. And for Don't Go Away Mad, it's a feel-good video that gives you a sense that these guys in this band are truly friends, even away from the music. The video opens with a woman leaving Vince's place after he gives her the boot. The band members finally get a hold of him and organize a jam together. Vince then flies to Los Angeles. He's welcomed at their practice spot with the rest of the band, and they all just look like they're having a great time playing along to the song, putting their arms around one another and giving high fives and everything. In an interview years later, Nicki later talked about remembering the video shoot and how it brought back memories from their earlier, simpler days, saying, quote, "That performance piece was shot in a little tiny stage, just the band being the band. That's how I think of Motley Crue. When I think of what it's like to be in a band, I don't think about stadiums and I don't think about arenas. and I don't think about jets. I think about a Marshall stack, drums set up on the floor, a bunch of ashtrays and pizza boxes, and just cranking out metal. That's what rock and roll is. So when you capture that, like in the rehearsal scene in Don't Go Away Mad, and the band being the band interacting with each other, you're getting a pretty clear vision of what it's like for us. Don't Go Away Mad was released as a single in May of 1990 and peaked at number 19 on the Billboard Hot 100 and continues to be a concert staple to this day. Overall, Dr. Feelgood brought Motley Crue commercial success like they never saw before. It proved to the band that they could make a hit album sober. In rock music, especially then, it was the status quo to associate being in a rock band with a lifestyle of excess. Their heroes followed that path, so it was easy for them to do the same. But it took a lot of guts and courage to make the mature and healthy decision to enter this new realm of making music like they had never had before up to this point. To go sober and to truly give it their all in the studio. To put the music to the forefront without any of the other distractions. Dr. Feelgood is one of the last kick-ass hair metal albums before grunge and the alternative movement took over in the early 90s. It's easy to mock the silliness of hair metal and how much of a parody of itself it became, but Motley Crue was good at not following those certain trends. They were those trendsetters throughout the 80s and moved away from aspects like, say, full-on makeup once they saw how much other bands were copying them. This was the era where these bands were as big as ever. It was the peak of profits for the record industry and the rise of MTV. It was the end of the 80s era, where excess was the status quo, the Ronald Reagan years, the Wall Street yuppies, the makeup, the big hair, sex, drugs, and rock and roll at its peak. And Motley Crue responded by getting sober and making the heaviest, most kick-ass album they could make. Dr. Feelgood was released on September 1st, 1989, eventually topping the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart at number one, their first number one record to date. The album has since sold more than 6 million copies worldwide. Bob Rock's production on it caught the eye of a certain drummer by the names of Lars Ulrich and a certain band by the name of Metallica. They brought Bob in to produce their next album, specifically to get part of the sound Motley was able to get on Dr. Feelgood. That Metallica record would go on to be one of the most successful albums of all time, Metallica's Black Album. With Dr. Feelgood, Motley Crue reached a new level of instrumental and lyrical sophistication. They transcended the party metal niche. They were never rock critic darlings, and they never tried to be. They were a fan-favorite type band, and the record sales throughout the 80s proved that. They walked the line, straddled the fence between heaven and hell, and came out on the other side all the better. Dr. Feelgood capped off an era, a decade of decadence, and summed up what Motley Crue stood for. A glam punk band that pulled no punches, not trying to be anyone else, with a focus on what was truly important, the music and none of that other bullshit. It was their finest effort front to back. Motley Crue was able to create something inspired, glam, sleazy, emotional, upbeat, and dirty, even if it took one member dying and coming back to life. Hey guys, thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with everything I got going on with this channel, be sure to follow my Instagram page. Also, I do have a YouTube channel where I condense individual stories from my podcast into short video form. So please like and subscribe on there as well. Thanks again.